Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada. Here's Mordecai Breenberg.
If peace proposals came in cereal packages, the proposals for peace in Palestine would fill the supergiant box. But like most cereal packages, once you open it, there is far more air than nutrition. To discuss the failure of peace proposals for the Palestine-Israel conflict, I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Lori Rani. She's a cultural anthropologist whose research centers on Palestine. She also is a co-founder of the premier and brilliant website on matters Palestinian, Electronic Intifada, and it's now expanded to encompass Electronic Iraq. Welcome back to Red Eye, Lori.
Thank you very much, Mordecai. Glad to be here.
Let's start with vocabulary, because there are a lot of proposals which could contribute to peace in the Middle East, and they're never called peace proposals. And there are other things that somehow magically get labeled with peace proposals. What kind of things aren't called peace proposals, but yet could contribute to resolution of the conflict?
Well, such things as basic documents as international humanitarian law, the Geneva Conventions as opposed to the Geneva Accord, the UN resolutions pertinent to this whole problem, Security Council resolutions, which are binding, UN Security Council Resolution 242 and 338. Nobody refers to these as peace implements, but in fact they are, because they're based on the idea of bringing or enforcing justice or the requirements and the criteria of justice in this particular conflict. And from that, we would hope and assume would ensue peace in terms of the cessation of the kinds of violence and the kinds of structural violence that we've been watching in increasing horror over the years.
So who gets to label some things as a peace proposal?
Well, of course, the media policy machine in the United States, and it benefits them to have Oslo, the peace accords, and this great moment on the White House lawn with the handshake between the late Prime Minister Rabin and Yasser Arafat and Shimon Peres. This was supposed to be some iconic defining moment in the peace process, when in fact, if you looked at the documents, Oslo was a great step down from what had been intended by the Madrid conference at the end of 1991. That was a little bit more hopeful. And then the Oslo Accords, like the Geneva Accords that we're hearing a lot about now, were hammered out in secret by small groups of people who didn't really represent anybody, who were not really getting input from any kind of popular base, and then came out of the blue with press conferences and press packets and CNN special attention to this wonderful development. Oh, look, a peace conference. Look, a peace proposal. This is optimistic, reason for hope. But when I looked over the Geneva Accords, detailed article after article, specification after specification, it made me think of that statement by the great English wit Samuel Johnson. We talked about marriage, and he defined marriage as the triumph of hope over experience. And I think these accords after accords are the same thing. I mean, we've been here before. Obviously, it didn't work. The Second Intifada was not started by, Palestinians who were angry. It was started by people who said, Oslo isn't working. We're not getting what we want. Our leadership, the Palestinian leadership, has basically sold us out. They're living in villas and wearing $8,000 suits. And our lives have actually gotten worse and worse and worse after 8 years of the so-called peace process of Oslo. And the Geneva Accords are only moderately better.
So I wanted to go maybe in a little more detail onto that. At one level, people in North America, Europe, are focused on what's called a peace process. The Palestinians are living a reality. So as these peace processes come forward, Madrid, as you say, followed by Oslo, Oslo 1, Oslo 2,
Y
Accords, and so forth, on now to the Geneva, what has happened to the Palestinian existence in the territories for which peace is supposedly being negotiated.
Oh, it's worsened considerably. The entire 5-6 years of the Oslo I and II saw the greatest expansion of Israeli settlements in the West Bank. And what has really been extremely damaging, and I'm sure listeners here have heard this mentioned, obviously, by people coming over on different study tours from Israel and from Palestine, is the bypass roads. The bypass roads throughout the West Bank are Jew-only roads. Only Jewish people can use them. And they cut through fields, they cut through farms, they cut through Palestinian villages, and they have screwed up life for many Palestinians. They've made it impossible for them to get to point A to point B. They've made it impossible for them to get to their farm fields, their orchards. So that was one really horrible thing. And then, of course, after the Second Intifada began, the Israeli response to it, and this was, let's not forget, before Sharon was in office, Barak was in office, the Labor Party, the great peace-loving Labor Party, the response of Barak and company was extremely brutal right from the start. Within a month of the beginning of the Second Intifada, you had the use of Apache attack helicopters against civilian buildings in Gaza and the use of F-16s. And again, this is under the Labor Party, who we like to think of, many of us, as somehow more humane. And, of course, Sharon got elected, so everything has gotten much worse. And now the latest report that was played up a lot in the British press, more so than in the U.S. or even the Canadian press, is that malnutrition in the West Bank and Gaza among children has reached levels that parallel those of sub-Saharan Africa. This is horrible. I mean, this has never happened. Even in the worst periods in the history, the modern history of the Middle East, from 1800 till now, you never had famine and malnutrition like this. And why? Because even if people are living a lifestyle where they do their own farming, what you have with all of these barricades, the wall, terrible thing, the bypassed roads, the checkpoints, the cordoning off of villages, is that you're preventing traditional social family networks from working. And that undercuts a whole infrastructure of a decent life for many people.
The late Edward Said said, these aren't peace processes, they are pacification processes, sort of recalling the name the Americans' effort to occupy and control Vietnam when they used their military campaigns, so that the peace process becomes a disguise for, in fact, an effort at consolidating conquest. Is that something you would agree with?
Oh, I would agree with, and I think that what I immediately flashed to in my mind when I hear pacification is what the United States did to the First Nations in the U.S., and I'm from the U.S. I know much more the history there about the U.S. government's treatment of the First Nations there than I do here in Canada. But that pretty much sums it up. I mean, the fate of the First Nations in the United States will be, if we don't do something about it, the same fate will occur to the Palestinians. And I'm sure that's what the Israelis absolutely intend.
People in our country, when they hear of a peace proposal and it arouses some hope, because naturally people have a sentiment for wanting to resolve conflict, and then peace proposal collapses, they frequently resort to the notion that, well, this conflict has been going on for centuries, these people are irreconcilable, and they just cast their human concern out the window. What would you say to a person who falls into that sort of response to hearing peace proposal, oh, it's promising, collapse, another peace proposal, oh, it's promising, collapse, and then falls into this attitude?
Well, I would say two things, and one would be media-related, and that would be you have to really go to the alternative media and get the real story, because what you're going to get on CNN or Fox or even sometimes CBC, unfortunately, is going to present it in those terms that, oh, they can never have peace there. This has been going on for thousands of years, which is the biggest line of BS ever. I mean, this is maybe a century-old conflict, but it has successfully been presented as an ancient, biblically-based conflict. That's not true. Do your research. Find out the facts. There's a lot of media, a lot of books, movies that you can find out about. The second thing is that it's not a problem of the inherent irresolvability. It's a problem of a lack of enforcement mechanisms. because, as I said from the beginning of this interview, we can look at the Geneva Conventions, which are part of international humanitarian law. We can look at all the UN resolutions. We could look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And all of those have all the answers anybody would need to give a roadmap, to use another word that's been misappropriated here, a roadmap to where, how do you get to peace? Well, you implement justice. It's all there in these documents, but you have to enforce it. So people should be working in general on how do you put teeth into international law. Especially now, that's a big issue because the United States government of George Bush is doing its utmost to completely gut international law in all of its forms, whether it has to do with trade, whether it has to do with the environment, and especially where it has to do with international criminal prosecution for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. And when we see what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan, we can clearly understand why they would want to take the teeth out of those things. But that's a big battle that everybody should be fighting for together to keep international law strong and capable of solving these problems all over the world, not just in Palestine.
Well, thank you very much, Lori.
You're welcome.
I've been speaking with Dr. Lori King-Irani. She's a co-founder of the Indispensable website on matters Palestinian. It's called Electronic Intifada, and it now also encompasses matters concerning the war upon and the occupation of Iraq. And the link for that is Electronic Iraq. If you want to contact that website, just go to www.electronicintifada.
You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts every Saturday morning from 9 until noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, Canada.